So tonight I want to talk about the title of my talk was How to Take Your Practice Deeper, the five factors of striving. And first of all, I want to talk with the word striving, because often when you hear Dharma talks and you hear people talk about striving, it has this sort of negative connotation to it. It has this sort of a thing of like, oh, you're striving, but striving is necessary to practice. I mean, if you don't strive, if you don't put energy into it, if you don't do something to make it happen, nothing's going to happen. So it's more in the sense of over striving, pushing too hard. That's when things are a problem, and that's very often you hear it talked about. So it's important that you understand that right at the beginning, that we're not talking about something that's if you do too much of it might be too it might not be good for your practice, but generally it's not a bad idea to strive at all. I mean, strive just means put energy into something, right? And this talk arose out of this verse in this much longer sutta. And this is in a section in the Majjhima Nikaya where the Majjhima Nikaya is divided into sections based on the kind of people the Buddha is talking to. Some of it's the Brahmins, and some of it's the monks, and some of it's just in general people. In this particular section, he's talking to various princes and kings and that sort of thing. And so in this sutta, I'm going to read verse 58. So there's a lot going on before we got here. And basically, he had just explained how he ended up teaching what he teaches, and the phases he went through in terms of practicing just concentration and learning concentration and seeing that wasn't enough, and practicing in austerities and that didn't work, and then he finally came back to teaching the middle way. And so the prince says, Venerable sir, even if he had one of those qualities, he could train under me. So what of the five? So too, prince, there are five factors of striving. What five? Here a bhikkhu has faith. He places his faith in the Tathagata's enlightenment thus. That blessed one is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of the worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. Then he is free from illness and affliction, possessing a good digestion that is neither too cool nor too warm, but medium and able to bear the strain of striving. Then he is honest and sincere, and shows himself as he actually is to the teacher and his companions in the holy life. Then he is energetic, in abandoning unwholesome states and undertaking wholesome states, steadfast, launching his effort with firmness and persevering in cultivating wholesome states. Then he is wise. He possesses wisdom regarding rise and disappearance that is noble and penetrative and leads to the complete destruction of suffering. These are the five factors of striving. So what fascinated me about this was that here's yet another list. I mean, the Buddhist teachings are full of lists, and I came across, oh, look, it's a very he approaches it, it's always the same sort of thing. He's approaching the idea of here's things you have to qualities you have to develop through practice, but it's like comes at it from a different direction, which I thought was interesting. So the first of these was faith in the Buddha's enlightenment. And I know the word faith is problematic. And so we're not talking about faith in the sense of, blind faith, like just whatever they say, they must know what they're talking about, so I'll have to just do what they say. That's not the kind of faith we're talking about here. I want to read something else. This is from another sutta. Look, a lot of what I'm going to do tonight is read things from other suttas. And oops, I got the wrong. Excuse me, I gotta make sure I got the right page. Yes, okay. So he's talking about how at some one point he had, this is right after his enlightenment, he was going, now what do I do? I mean, this is like a big thing has happened. Now what do I do? And this is sort of a description of that process that he went through. And this is the Buddha talking. I consider this Dhamma that I have attained is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning. So you can't just figure it out, right? Subtle, to be experienced by the wise. But this generation delights in attachment, takes delight in attachment, rejoices in attachment. It is hard for such a generation to see this truth, namely specific conditionality, dependent origination. And it is hard to see this truth, namely the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. If I were to teach the Dhamma, others would not understand me, and that would be wearying and troublesome for me. So here he's saying, well, yeah, this is great. I'm really happy, but there's no way anybody will understand what I'm saying. So he's like thinking he's not going to teach at all. This, of course, upsets the holy people. Then Bhikkhu Brahma Samapati knew with his mind, the thoughts in my mind, and he considered, the world will be lost, the world will perish, since the mind of the Tathagata, accomplished and fully enlightened, inclines to inaction rather than to teaching the Dhamma. So whether this is actually some divine being, you know, which is the Buddhist cosmology, or this is just like, you know, you sort of see this is another aspect of the Buddha's mind, in a sense. Then, just as quickly as a strong man might extend his flexed arm or flex his extended arm, the Brahma Samapati vanished in the Brahma world and appeared before me. He arranged his upper robe on one shoulder and, extending his hands in reverential salutations toward me, said, Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma. Let the Sublime One teach the Dhamma. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who are wasting through not hearing the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand the Dhamma. So basically he's saying, you know, yeah, a lot of people aren't going to understand what you have to say, but some people are actually going to understand. Some people have little dust in their eyes. I love that image. It's like, you know, some of us have like mud caked in our eyes. If we're talking about seeing clearly, then just having a little dust in your eyes means you sort of see, but it's not perfectly clear yet. And the teaching, the Dhamma, will make it clear. And then the Buddha replies, Then I listened to the Brahma's pleading, and out of compassion for beings, note what he says, out of compassion for beings. So he's teaching from a place of compassion. I surveyed the world with the eye of a Buddha. Surveying the world with the eye of a Buddha, I saw beings with little dust in their eyes and with much dust in their eyes, with keen faculties and dull faculties, with good qualities and bad qualities, easy to teach and hard to teach. So he's seen, yeah, there's some people who are going to, you know, there's lots of people out there who will hear the teaching. Some of them will get it quicker than others. But he's willing to do something about it. So, and then, this is an interesting tidbit. This is in the Samyutta Nikaya. And this is in the section where, once again, Brahmas and Devas are coming to study and be with the Buddha. And he's speaking here. This is the Brahma Samapati again. And he's talking about the fact that not only is there the Buddha right now, in the context of 2,500 years ago, right now, but there were other Buddhas in the past, and there will be more Buddhas in the future. So this is a recurring thing that happens in the world. But the Buddhas of the past, the future Buddhas, and he who is the Buddha now, removing the sorrow of many, all have dwelt, will dwell, and dwell, deeply revering the true Dhamma. For the Buddhas, this is a natural law. Therefore, one desiring his own good, aspiring for spiritual greatness, should deeply revere the true Dhamma, recollecting the Buddha's teachings. So what he's driving at here is by, we have to believe that the Buddha was enlightened, but the main thing is we have to not worship the Buddha. The Buddha actually talked with us a lot. He said, no, don't worship me. Don't revere me. Revere what I've taught. Revere the Dhamma itself. He wasn't a god. He wasn't a deity. He was just a human being who happened to achieve this thing called enlightenment. But he's just like us. He's no different than us in terms of just got, you know, two arms and two legs and a body and lives in the world, you know, digests food, all those are normal things. So to me, this is what it means to take refuge in the Buddha, to take refuge in the fact that the Buddha was enlightened, that he taught the Dhamma, and it's the Dhamma that's important. It's the Dhamma that wakes us up, leads us towards enlightenment. So that was the first of the five. He said, you know, it's like faith in the Buddha's enlightenment was the first of the five factors of striving. Then he says, freedom from illness and affliction. Oh, take care of your body. It's really a simple instruction, right? Just take care of the body. This body is all we have. This is the vehicle allows us to practice. Without taking care of this body, we won't be able to practice. So it's actually quite important that we do that. And here's the Buddha again. He's talking about the time when he was practicing with quite strong austerity. I mean, there's a whole sutta here, whole section where he talks about how he was so thin that you could see his vertebrae by looking at his front, at his stomach. They didn't have to look at them sticking out of the back. I mean, it's like, you know, he's saying this is how extreme. And this was like he'd fallen into this group of five other people who were all hanging out together in the forest. And their whole belief was, if we just suffer enough, we'll really understand suffering. So let's see how much we can suffer. How austere can we be? You know, living on nettle soup and exciting things like that. And then at a certain point, after he's done this for 5 years or so, he goes, oh, wait a second. I recall that when my father, the Sakyan, was occupied, while I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, quite secluded from sensual pleasure, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered upon and abided in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought with rapture and pleasant pleasure born of seclusion. Could that be the path to enlightenment? Then following on that memory came the realization that is indeed the path to enlightenment. I thought, why am I afraid of that pleasure that has nothing to do with sensual pleasure and unwholesome states? I thought, I'm not afraid of that pleasure, since it has nothing to do with sensual pleasure and unwholesome states. I considered, it is not easy to attain that pleasure with a body so excessively emaciated. Suppose I ate some solid food, some boiled rice and porridge, and I ate some solid food, some boiled rice and porridge. Now at that time, the five bhikkhus were waiting upon me, thinking, you know, if our recluse Gautama achieves some higher state, he will inform us. But when I ate the boiled rice and porridge, the five bhikkhus were disgusted and left me, thinking, the recluse Gautama now lives luxuriously He has given up his striving and reverted to luxury. I actually ate some food. Shocking. So what he's getting at here by his own example is, first of all, that extreme austerity doesn't work. Just concentration doesn't work. But if we can tune into, but not be enamored by the pleasure of deep concentrated states of mind, that will want make us want to go further in the practice. And that's the jhana states are quite pleasurable. They are interesting and they are pleasurable. They have this sort of sweetness that, in my experience, there's nothing else that's like that. And he's saying that this isn't like sensual pleasure for sensual pleasure's sake. This is just something that arises as we go into deeper states of concentration. So we have to be careful. As you know, the jhana states, just like these deep concentration states, can become very seductive. Like, oh, you want to just hang out in this pleasurable mind state, which is what the Buddha did originally. When he first started practicing, he was practicing just concentration because he studied with two great concentration masters. And he said, no, that doesn't work. I can't, because while I'm in these deep concentrated states, I'm not experiencing any suffering. But as soon as I come out and come back to like functioning in the world, then I'm back in the world suffering again. And I can't stay in those deep concentrated states all the time. It isn't possible. I need to function in the world. And so he was saying that this other way, this middle way, will work for him. So we need to take care of this vehicle as best we can. I mean, we all have, you know, none of us are, most of us here are not so young anymore. And we all have, you know, physical things we're dealing with, but it's all this part of life. And as much as we can, given our physical condition, we want to keep this body as functioning as clearly and crisply as we can, so we can practice. It's really important that we actually do that. Then we come to honesty and sincerity. So here, this is sort of like talking about, the our character in the world, our how we operate and live in the world. And there's this interesting sutta here where the Buddha is teaching his son Rahula. The Buddha was married. He left home when he was 29. But he'd already had a son and a wife. They eventually both became his disciples. And there's several suttas where the Buddha is teaching Rahula. And he's emphasizing in this particular sutta how important it is to be honest. So, then the Blessed One left a little water in the water vessel and asked the Venerable Rahula, "Rahula, do you see this little water left in the water vessel?" "Yes, Venerable Sir." "Even so, little Rahula, is the recluseship of those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie." There's always, even if there's just a little bit of water left in something, in other words, even if you only do this a little bit, your recluseship, your practice is not, it doesn't work. Then the Blessed One threw away the little water that was left and asked the Venerable Rahula, "Rahula, did you see that little water that was thrown away?" "Yes, Venerable Sir." "Even so, Rahula, those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie have thrown away their recluseship." Then the Blessed One turned the water vessel upside down and asked the Venerable Rahula, "Rahula, do you see this water vessel turned upside down?" "Yes, Venerable Sir." "Even so, Rahula, those who are not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie have turned their recluseship upside down." So he's used three different images here to point out to Rahula how important honesty is, how important not telling lies is. It's right speech, and this is one part of right speech. But he's picked this one particular thing because it's so important. And think about, I don't know if you've ever been around people who just never do that, never always tell the truth, and how relaxing it is. You never have to sort of wonder, well, is that, you know, is that really true? It's like being around people who are always honest is a wonderful gift you give to other people. If you can actually be honest all the time, they can relax with you. It's quite a powerful thing to do. And more importantly, your mind is never then occupied with, oh, I said that thing, and now you're having guilt and embarrassment and shame, as the Buddha says, shame. And though none of those things arise. So the mind, this is like a part of why it's so important, is that it allows the mind to go still. The other thing about telling a lie is often then, you know, you tell one thing to one person and another thing to another person, then you got to remember who you told what to, and now you have to tell another lie to hide the first act you told the first lie. It just snowballs very quickly into much more complicated speech. None of it is very calming and relaxing. The mind doesn't go still that way. And then the next of these is, he said, you have to be energetic. This is, he's talking about right effort, you know, the sixth step on the Eightfold Path. And I'm going to read something by Ajahn Chah here, who talks about this, I think, in quite a wonderful way. He's talking about putting energy into the practice. Practice really has to depend on steadfastness, fastness, and patient endurance. Some people start to practice meditation and they have ideas and desires as to how they want it to be. They expect the mind to be calm right away, but the old seeds and habits of turmoil are there. So the practitioners will have to experience their ripening. It is important to make efforts where this distress appears. You might well feel we would be fine without such disciplines that cause us to feel bothered and oppressed. We could eat and sleep in comfort and at will. We could talk about whatever we like when we have the urge. We could go here and there as we wish, and following our impulses, this would bring well-being. Remember, this is addressed to bhikkhus, the monks who shouldn't do any of those things, right? But it's sort of a pretty good description of how we live our lives if we're not careful. The teaching of the Buddha talks about resisting, grating against things. The way of transcendence grates against the worldly. Right view grates against wrong view. Purity grates against impurity. These things are always going to be incompatible. In the scriptures, there's a fable to illustrate this. Before the Buddha attained enlightenment, when he accepted and eaten rice porridge from the milkmaid Sujata, he set the dish on the surface of a southerly flowing river and made the aspiration, if I'm going to become supremely awakened Buddha, may the dish flow north. In other words, against the current. The dish flowed to the north. So what he's getting at here is right effort is hard, number one, but it goes against the grain of our culture. It goes against the grain of our human nature, which is to take the easy way, to find the pleasant, to find the nice things in life and think that's going to somehow make everything okay. But it doesn't work. So another problem with this idea is of putting in effort, of striving, is that, you know, there are teachings that say, oh, you know, you have Buddha nature. So you just have to sort of let that Buddha nature come out. Just let it come out. You know, it's like, you're fine just as you are. You have Buddha nature. Then, and the question arises, well, if that's true, then why do we have to put any effort into doing anything? If I have Buddha nature anyway. Well, in terms of absolute reality, yes, we all have innate Buddha nature. That's absolutely true. But in terms of day-to-day relative reality experience, we don't know this. In fact, we don't experience it often. We do sometimes. Often we don't. In fact, we often experience the opposite. You know, the world seems full of suffering, and we seem to be anything but perfect. And so we have to shift these patterns of habitual not being perfect, not being, having Buddha nature flowing out of us and expressing itself in everything we do. The Pali word for effort or energy is virya, and the root of that is the word vira, which means, is roughly translated as hero. To put in effort, to put in energy, is a courageous thing. It isn't easy. It takes courage to go deep into this practice. And because we're going against everything that culture thinks, instead of just flowing along with the southerly flowing river, we're going to flow against the river. We're going against the current of our culture. So effort is the striving, this is essential. And that traditionally, when we talk about right effort or wholesome effort, or right striving, whatever you want to call it, there are four aspects to it that we always have to look at. And these are four things we can all be mindful of. First of these is to do whatever you can to prevent unwholesome mind states from arising. It seems so obvious, right? Like, what can I do to avoid getting caught in unwholesome mind states? And this requires we look at everything we do. We go, oh, whenever I do this, whenever I read this or watch this kind of movie or hang out with those people or whatever, that's the thing that takes me to a place where I can end up with unwholesome mind states. Or whenever I'm sitting and practicing and this story comes up and I start getting caught in that story and believing that story, it always ends up in an unwholesome mind state. Oh. Maybe I have to sort of be aware of that and not go there, either physically in the world and how I act or speak, or, you know, what's happened, how I get caught over and over again by the same old stories as I'm sitting and going, now I don't need to go through that story anymore. And so this is, in a sense, this is just right understanding put into action. Think of it that way. Right understanding is, oh, I know what I need to do. And then, oh, I need to put effort into it so that I don't do that instead. So the second aspect is to be a right effort is to do whatever you can to get rid of unwholesome mind states once they have arisen. This is a little tricky. You know, first of all, it implies that you can see that an unwholesome mind state has arisen, that you're not just so caught in it, you're just lost in delusion and whatever else is going on. So this takes effort. You know, and basically, this has a lot to do with these same old stories we tell ourselves over and over again. I'm not good enough. Oh, why should it be this way? Why isn't it that way? oh, that person back there did this terrible thing to me, and I should have said this, and blah, blah, blah. You know, all those stories that repeat over and over again in our heads. And we have to, these stories hook us because they have a strong emotional hook, usually. They seem so compelling. But basically, thinking these same thoughts, going through these same patterns, is not useful at all. Isn't wholesome at all, you know. Often these stories lead us to the places where we end up in an unwholesome mind state. One of my teachers said once that if you've had the same thought 5 times in a row, that's enough. Now just stop. Don't do that anymore. You can actually, and at the same time, we have to be careful not to, I know this is unpleasant, I'm not enjoying this, so I'm just going to go, you know, I'm going to avoid it right away. It's wise, it's wholesome to look at these stories, to feel them out, to see what lies underneath them and on an emotional level and on a physical level often. But doing that over and over and over with the same old story doesn't make a lot of sense. You know? So we have to be, often it's like when we're caught in those stories, when we notice, you know, here I am sitting meditating, and all of a sudden, you know, I mean, who knows where I've been for the last 2 minutes? And, oh, it's that old story again. It's all that old story. One thing you can do is sort of step back from the mental process, drop into the body, and just see what it feels like in the body. That unhooks you from the story, number one. So the story is now, might still be running in the background, but now you're actually being mindful of the body, which is a wholesome thing to do. So you can just shift in that way. And sometimes, you know, you have to do more than that. And this is Joseph Goldstein, a little passage from his book, Mindfulness, that I love. He's talking about these, somehow powerful these unwholesome mind states can be. They just rip us. Right? When all else fails, the Buddha suggested forcibly suppressing the unwholesome thought. One way of doing this is imagining oneself shooting down these thoughts as soon as they arise, like shooting down targets in an amusement park shooting gallery game. I found this method particularly helpful with recurrent unwholesome thoughts that have already been seen so many times that it's not a question of denial or suppression of the feeling. Here is an attitude that takes no quarter, but involves a sense of humor. I call this method cowboy dharma. And I love the fact that he emphasizes that you need to have a sense of humor. I mean, if you start to think about it a little bit and you think, God, that story again. Here I am whirling around about that thing that happened 20 years ago and I'm getting all upset again. How ridiculous is that? How crazy is that? That we just, and we can sort of laugh at it. Just laugh at ourselves and laugh at the whole process and go, oh my God. And just once again, it's like it changes it from an unwholesome mind state to a wholesome one. Just being a sense of lightness about the whole thing, not letting it grip you. Being able to just have a sense of humor. And then, as he says, this cowboy dharma, like literally, you know, shooting these thoughts down as they come along. It's an interesting way to think about it. It's like, oh, I can, these are just thoughts I can dispose of. Just like, you know, the targets in a shooting gallery at an amusement park. Sometimes you have to imply cowboy dharma. If you don't like the image of a gun, well, you can think of some other way to do that that works for you. Maybe just use a crossbow or something. I don't know. The third aspect of right effort is the part into the first. do whatever you can to cultivate wholesome mindsets. Once again, this seems so obvious. Do things that bring about calm, joy, compassion, loving kindness, equanimity. But how often do we do this? How often do we go, oh, let's do something that's going to bring joy to my life right now, or bring calm to my life, or connect me compassionately with others? You know, this is like a conscious choice of how we live our lives. It really is a conscious choice. You have to think about all the choices you make. Every choice you make, either go, does this lead me to a more wholesome mind state? Oh, good, then I'll continue with this. No, it doesn't. Okay, I don't need to do that anymore. But you have to be mindful of what's going on. You have to be mindful and go and see clearly where this is headed. And then consciously put in the effort to move in that direction. Now, the fourth and final aspect of right effort is often the most difficult. When wholesome mind states have arisen in the mind, do whatever you can to preserve them. Once again, this seems like, well, of course, but it's not that easy. First of all, you have to actually be mindful enough to see that a wholesome mind state has arisen. Often when a wholesome mind state arises, it's just pleasant and we're just sort of bouncing along smiling, but we don't tune into the fact, oh, this is actually a really wholesome mind state. Because once we tune into that, then we start to go, oh, what can I do to actually make this last longer? Here I am in this wholesome mind state. Mindfulness has arisen. Joy has arisen. Concentration has arisen. What can I do to continue in this way without, of course, this yellow flag warning, without sort of grasping it and thinking, oh, this is great. I want to keep it and I'm going to have more of this forever. I'm always going to, whenever I meditate now, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to have this wonderful, joyous feeling. So we have to, but often what happens instead is that, you know, this wholesome mind state arises, and if we're not careful, we first of all, we notice it, and then we something along the lines of, oh, you know, the world's in such turmoil, how could I just sit here filled with joy? Or, I don't deserve to feel this good. I'm unworthy. I'm not ready. I'm not pure enough to hang out here. And so the first thing is to actually, when a wholesome mind state arises, is to just accept it. Oh, a wholesome mind state. Isn't that, this is nice. It's okay. I'm fine with this wholesome mind state being here. I don't want to grasp it, but if I can sort of stay concentrated and mindful, it'll probably continue for a while. Of course, like all mind states, all wholesome mind states are just like all other mind states. They'll arise, they'll be there for a while, and they're going to be gone. But can I sort of consciously focus on being still and focused, or whatever it is that makes that wholesome mind state continue? I've experienced this in longer retreats when really powerful wholesome mind states arise, and you notice them and you go, oh, I think I'll just sit here really still. Like you sort of become conscious of how still you're sitting and how soft your breath is and all these things that just like they're little things that, you know, if you just sort of keep that stillness and that focus, this wholesome mind state, this sense of concentration or joy or whatever it is that's arisen will continue. And you consciously do just that. Yeah. And I can remember being in one of these really deep wholesome mind states, and you know, the bell rang right at the end of the sit, and I was kind of like, I'm not going to get up. No, sorry, that bell rang. I'm just going to sit right here. And that was the wholesome thing to do at the time. Just stay right here. It's okay to not have to follow all the rules and jump up and go practice something else or do whatever the next thing was. Just stay there and enjoy this, keep this wholesome mind state solidly there. It's like you have to learn that it's okay to be joyful, which for some people is a big ask, right? To learn that it's okay to be joyful. It takes effort to let that, notice the joyful, wholesome mind states, and then preserve them as best you can. Understanding, no matter what you do, it's going to go. But can I make it last longer? I'm not expecting it to come back the next time you sit, not expect anything. Just right now, let's just hang out with this. It's a really skillful thing to do, because the longer you stay there, the more you remember the sensation of it, the more it encourages you to keep practicing. That's my experience with these strong, wholesome mind states. Is the more you experience them, the more you think, oh, because you see how directly your practice leads to there. And you go, oh, I should probably keep practicing. I want to practice a little more. Maybe I want to go do another retreat next year, or whatever it is that encourages you to do. And then the last thing in this list of five, so we had, you know, faith in the Buddha's enlightenment, freedom from illness and affliction, honesty and sincerity, and energetic effort, putting in right effort. The last of these was you need to be wise. It's interesting, huh? In the Samyutta Nikaya, I just pulled out a little verse here. And this is, this samsara is without discoverable beginning. So this is like pointing very directly to that idea that we can't figure things out. We can't figure out why things are, when the world started, when's it going to end, all those questions, metaphysical questions. You know, I've talked about this before, I know. But it's like we can't figure things out. We keep trying to figure things out. It's our Western mind habit of wanting to be in control. If I can figure things out, then I'm in control of this process. And we have to give up that idea that we can be in control of it. We can just experience it. It's a different way. And what this means, basically, is that our practice, there's a shift in our practice at a certain point. You know, in the sutta, the Buddha says, let me just read this again. He says, then he is wise, he possesses wisdom regarding rise and disappearance that is noble and penetrative and leads to complete destruction of suffering. So he's talking about seeing deeply into the nature of the world and of life, of everything. Everything is just arising, it's there for a while, and then it's gone. And this becomes what happens on our practice. At a certain point, we go through this shift in our practice where at least sometimes we're not paying attention to the details of what's arising at the sense doors. You know, we're not noting there's an itch, or there's a thought, you know, those things that we keep noting all the time. Instead, we're seeing that underneath all of those arisings, no matter what it is, no matter where, which sense door this thing is arising at, it's almost the same thing. Something's arising, it's there for a while, and then it's gone. That's where wisdom starts to come in, when we start to see the underlying process. Because if this leads to right understanding on a much deeper level, because it leads us to understand unsatisfactoriness. If everything is just arising, therefore, all, and then gone, there's nothing satisfactory in what's arising or not arising. Is this stuff happening all the time? And if we think somehow, if I hold on to some of this stuff, if I grasp it, if I cling to it, I'm going to be happy. We go, well, of course that's not going to work, because it's going to go away for sure. Because we know that, because we see it. It's not like an intellectual idea, oh yeah, impermanence, I understand that. It's like something we got to start to actually see, this process, this flow of just things arising, that they're there for a while, and then they're gone. And then something else arises, and so on, and so on, and so on, and so on. That's all that's ever going on. So how could we possibly think that's going to, anything in that flow is going to bring happiness? It might be momentary moments of, oh, isn't this great? But it's all going to go away. Nothing is permanent. And so everything's unsatisfactory. And of course, then the sense of a separate self, if all is, it's just stuff. Of all, we never see a self, we never can actually see the self. All we can see is this flow that's rising and falling and rising and falling. Then how can we have a sense of a separate self when there's nothing solid there to be a self? This is wisdom. This is how wisdom arises through the practice. It's the process of it. I have a sentence here I want to read. It's important to remember that this all happens gradually, right? And that it starts with faith in the idea that it's possible. Without that faith in the Buddha's enlightenment, where this all began 45 minutes ago, without that faith in the fact that enlightenment is possible, that the Buddha was enlightened and that he said, There are those with little dust in their eyes who are also capable of becoming enlightened. Without that faith, our motivation will never be strong enough. It all starts with that faith. And then we have to, take care to, make sure that we take care of the body, that we act in a way, in a way that have with integrity in the world. We have to apply energy. We have to consciously make sure we have a balanced energy going towards the practice, which leads us to go against the flow of our culture. And then we have to sort of, what will happen is we'll start to see this wisdom will arise. Just naturally through our practice, we'll start to see the underpinnings of everything that's arising, that it's always this flow of change. And that's called, often they talk about mindfulness as seeing things as they really are. That's what that means. We start to see that, those underpinnings more clearly, not as something theoretical, but as something we can actually experience. This is like what we have in our practice. Some of the time, remember I said, man, happens gradually. So you might just get a little glimpse of that to start with. And then over time, it'll become more obvious over time. And that's once again, sort of, that's faith in the Buddha's enlightenment, because this is exactly the process the Buddha went through. He didn't just one day go, oh, now I'm enlightened. He practiced hard, really diligent practice for a long time. And gradually became to a place of enlightenment. So as always, I'll finish with a bit of poetry here. This is from Dana Fall's book, Go In and In. It's called Staring at the Bones. And I love this. This is sooner or later, life in its variety of wisdom choose the meat from the bones of my illusions. It sucks the marrow from inside and throws the dry bone to bleach in a pile. Expectations are treated with equal disdain. Stripped of their finery, they are revealed as nothing more than future plans, easy ways to stay safe, roadmaps drawn by a blind cartographer trying to imagine distant destinations. This is the present moment's boot camp. Life's lack of rules will be obeyed, or I'll spend my time peeling potatoes in the past. I can choose to leave behind the skeletons of what I thought I knew and raise the flag of truth on the front porch. I can take a single step and wait for the next one to be revealed. I can only know where I am in this moment. Anything else is a desperate attempt to clothe the bones and set them walking. I love that image. Anything else is a desperate attempt to clothe the bones and set them walking.